Ignition sequence start. 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0. All engine running. Liftoff. We have a liftoff.
Fly me to the moon. Let me play among the stars. Let me see what spring is like on Jupiter and Mars.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Space Talks, a science-based show with a particular interest in all things space. This is Stephen Lowry along with co-host Tim Woods, who's here in the studio in Salmon Arm. And welcome, Tim. What is today's topic?
Well, Steve, we're interested in the laws of space, what they are and what they might be. And I guess we're also interested in why we even need those laws and what might be the prompts that could make us worry about what those laws need to become.
You know, before researching this, Tim, I didn't even know there were space laws, so here we go. First of all, just a little backtrack in time about why do we have laws? Well, we have laws to protect and regulate our lives. And so there are three branches that help make up that law. And the first being the executive branch of any government, and that's the ruling government that comes up with an idea that might be a law. Secondly, there's the legislative branch, which approves or amends that and enacts it, and then it becomes a law. And the third branch of government is the judicial, which enforces the law. Not to be confused with the police. The police may arrest someone who they believe is breaking a law, but it's the judiciary that determines the innocence or guilt. So in Canada, the executive branch is typically the ruling party of Canada. Legislative is, of course, the House of Commons. And the judicial is the Supreme Court of Canada at the highest level. So a basic principle of international air law is that every state has an exclusive sovereignty over their airspace, over their territory. But in researching this, we found out that it was basically based upon laws of the sea. Tim, what are some of these laws of the sea?
Well, they of course became very necessary as a result of conflict on the seas, conflict between military powers, conflict between commercial enterprises, the fishery debates that have gone on for a long time over whose water and whose fish. So we have laws, and they've been updated, the law of the sea. It establishes a 12 nautical mile breadth of territorial sea contiguous to a country's land, with the right of innocent passage being granted to those who travel the waters. So there's an example of a decision made to say, well, those are the waters of Canada, but it's okay for you to sail them if it's an innocent reason to do so. That would be one example of a nautical law.
Okay, and then how does that reflect itself upon fisheries, for example?
Well, I can remember when the Spanish were fishing off the shore of Newfoundland, and it became tremendously controversial as to whether or not those boats catching fish were contravening sea law. And there's an example where you have a migratory species of fish. As soon as they would hit the continental shelf, it became easier for the Spanish to catch them. And I remember the premier of Newfoundland, Brian Tobin, made great hay politically, saying that they were catching fish in Canadian waters. And it can lead to conflict.
And I remember a conflict between Iceland and England over a similar thing. And so we have exclusive economic zone areas of influence. What are some other examples of maritime law, Tim?
Well, I believe that there are significant rules set out for the conduct of marine research. You know, who can do it and where. We've imposed duties on all states to ensure that through proper conservation and management measures, you've got a sustainable fish resource. We have rules and laws that provide coastal states with the right to prevent, reduce, and control marine pollution from vessels in ice-covered areas within the limits of the EEZ, which is the exclusive economic zone that each country has in the waters off its coast.
So from an historical point of view, then maritime laws came first. And then we have the advent of aircraft and the law of airspace begins. And that first started off, a principle of airspace sovereignty was affirmed in the Paris Convention in 1919. And subsequently, other various multilateral treaties ensued. And vertically now, airspace over a country ends where space begins, that is 100 kilometers up. So if you're flying over France at an altitude of, let's say, 5,000 meters, you are in French airspace. And in 1944, the Chicago Conference established five freedoms of the air. The third and the fourth and the fifth deal with passengers being able to be picked up and flown to their destination. But the first is the privilege of flying across a country nonstop. However, if you do so, you are subject to fees and tariffs. For example, if an airplane is flying from, let's say, Stockholm to Seattle, it has to cross over Canadian airspace. And even though it doesn't stop anywhere in Canada, NAV Canada charges for services made available for flights over Canadian-controlled airspace. Fees are applied on a per-flight basis based upon the distance flown over Canadian territory and the weight of the aircraft, even though the aircraft doesn't land.
Appropriately so. You know, I wanted to take a sidestep here, Steve, and mention something. I don't know if you've heard this phrase, the tragedy of the commons. Well, let me explain why I think it might be relevant here. You're living in a town, and you have laws about where garbage can be put or taken care of or disposed of. You take care of your own property because you want it to look a certain way, and there's certain things you can and can't do. Then you walk into town, and you come to the town square. Well, who really owns that? Well, maybe we all do. But people can throw their garbage down there with sometimes relative immunity. If you think about you own a piece of land and you're polluting the air, well, the pollution goes up into the air. Who really owns the air? You don't really worry about it as the landowner causing the pollution. So we have these laws to try and address the consequence of bad behavior or to encourage good behavior. And the tragedy of the commons is that people seem to think that it's okay, some people think it's okay, to pollute those. Pollution in the ocean, a freighter in the middle of the Atlantic decides to dump refuse over the sides, has an oil leak. Oil goes into the ocean. Well, who's there to police that, or is anyone in a position to police it? And so we have these common areas in space, the air over Canada that we're now charging people to fly over, or the town square where you have to have a police officer arresting somebody for throwing their garbage in it. Well, now we come to space where we have to start thinking, can anything go in space, or do we need laws to address issues that can come up and affect all of us?
And that's a really good question. And with regard to space, we talk about where does it begin? We're talking 100 kilometers up. But let's just take a little bit closer look to our own properties. For example, the Civil Aviation Act of 1949 in Canada says that a trespass or nuisance suit shall not be because an aircraft flies over your head at a reasonable height. And the court ruled that a landowner owns at least as much space over the top of their roof as they can occupy or use in connection with the land. In other words, a property owner owns only so much of the air over its house as can be used in connection with the land below. Everything about that is navigable airspace available to the public. And while the Supreme Court hasn't explicitly accepted that as an upper limit of property ownership, it's a useful guideline in trespass cases. So unless you own some very tall buildings, your private airspace over your house ends somewhere between 80 and 500 feet above the ground.
What about drones? They're new to this landscape, are they not?
You would think so. If you fly a drone low over someone's land without their permission, you could be liable for a trespass or nuisance, even if you do not personally go onto that person's land. You can fly a drone in your neighborhood, which is classified as a residential area, as long as you don't land or take off on someone else's property without getting their permission. And here's another really, shall we say, goofy aspect. You can fly a micro drone as close to people as is, quote, safe, including over the top of them, as long as you respect the CARS 900.06 law. Yeah, right, we're going to remember that, which states that no person shall operate a drone in such a reckless or negligent manner as to endanger their safety. And with respect to privacy issues, those drones can carry cameras, and they may capture information, such as facial images and license plates, but they must secure that data, when one way or another at their home, and blur any pertinent images if they use them publicly.
Fingers crossed there, right, Stu?
Well, if I had a drone flying low over my house...
You might think it an invasion of your privacy.
I certainly would, and at the very least, I'd turn the hose on it. Now we've sort of segued into outer space. We've talked about that in examining space law, we first had to make mention of what are laws. We had to make mention of the laws of the sea, and then the laws of airspace and aircraft. And now we're talking about outer space. So, okay, here we go.
So I've got some... I was thinking about what kinds of crises might happen in space that would prompt us to say, isn't there a law for that? Or is there... Certainly isn't an app for it. Is there a law that has to address it? So, for example, what could happen in space that we can now imagine happening that would say, what's the law, who's running it, and where do I find out more? Murder. Is it possible there could be a murder in space? At this point, I'd have to say, well, if we're going to start commercializing and mining the lunar surface, at some point, greed could translate into people living there for a long time in conditions, who knows, what kind of people, what kind of crime.
Or indeed, two people on a voyage around the Earth or whatever, and they get on each other's nerves.
One's a Leafs fan.
Oh, no.
Justifiable homicide? Not in space, surely. Accidents. There could be any number of accidents that have repercussions for other people. We know about the concern about the militarization of space. That would be another place where you would hope there were laws. Exploitation. We've just mentioned the idea of lunar mining. Is there any reason to worry about that? Is it a do-whatever-you-want situation, or might we have laws to preclude certain kinds of behavior? Nuclear accidents. I think, Steve, you were mentioning one example of that earlier to me.
There was the famous one of the Russian nuclear-powered spacecraft that came down over the Northern Territories, and it took millions and millions of dollars to try to find it, tried to bill the Russians for it. Good luck with that.
So the Russians could just say, sorry, it's not our table. Another interesting one I thought would be worth pursuing would be robotics. There's almost no doubt that in any kind of near-term future of exploration of space, there will be an explosion in the usage of robots and robotics. What laws might apply to those? We have a hard time with that here on Earth.
Well, especially so. I mean, so many spacecraft rely upon computer programs to be where they are and how they got there. You can just well imagine that, oh, sorry, our errant satellite bumped into your high-tech reconnaissance satellite. Didn't mean to do it. It was an accident. Must have been a cosmic ray that caused the computer to malfunction.
Somebody's lunch, somebody's dog, somebody got eaten, I don't know. There's any number of excuses. Here's another one. This ties back into that reference to the tragedy of the commons. Contamination. Now, we do hear about this from time to time, I think, already, where people are saying, oh, you're going to start sending spacecraft, landing them on other celestial bodies, and leaving behind God knows what horrible things that will contaminate the surface of that planet. Who's to say you can't do that? What laws might there be involved in that? And so there you're stretching that notion of tragedy of the commons from the town square to some distant planet.
There are already communities or groups of people that may not mind us sending a space probe to a planet, that they don't want it to land on that planet and change its life forms that may be there, or it's simply the fact that you're littering, like driving along, throwing a candy wrapper out the car window.
I'm pretty sure that, I'm more than sure. I know for a fact that when we brought back lunar rocks, there was fear about the contamination of those rocks and what might be on them when they got back to our planet, and they were put in isolation and inspected 6 ways from Sunday. And more recently, we've been bringing back samples taken from asteroids with a similar concern.
And the Apollo astronauts all left little bags of feces on the moon. They did not bring them back. And of course, en route to the moon, they urinated, and that urine went overboard as little crystals of ammonia and nitrides. So we've been polluting the space between there and then.
So the law has to catch up to what we've already started.
Well, do you know what the ISS does with theirs and their dirty laundry and that? They just chuck it overboard. Gravity overtakes it, and it all burns up in the atmosphere. Does not come back in a little sealed bag and is properly disposed of.
So don't try this at home. Would that be throw it out the second story window?
You throw it out the second story.
Hope it burns up by the time it hits the ground.
You will be out in the morning picking it up with mom and dad looking over you. At Caltech in 1942, a gentleman by the name of Theodore von Karman and other rocket scientists banded together to form a company called the Aerojet Rocket Company, and with the help of lawyer Andrew Haley, ensured that their rockets were in accordance with law. And von Karman is, of course, the gentleman who established the 100-kilometer limit as being the demarcation of space. Now, when the Soviet Union launched its first satellite, Sputnik 1, in 1957, of course that satellite crossed international boundaries, and space law became a field independent from air law. In 1965, that same lawyer, Halley, published the fundamental textbook, Space Law and Government. And the Outer Space Treaty that the United Nations began looking at was spurred by the development of ICBMs, intercontinental ballistic missiles, in the 50s, which could reach their targets by traveling through outer space. So, in essence, they have laws against bombers going through your airspace, but they didn't have anything about it, a missile being launched through your own airspace, traveling above 100 kilometers and then coming through yours. So the Outer Space Treaty had to come into existence. But before it did, Tim, what happened in June 1962?
The United States conducted 5 nuclear detonations in space, the largest being the explosion of a 1.4 megaton hydrogen bomb 400 kilometers in space. 1 year later, in October of 1963, the UN unanimously adopted a resolution prohibiting the introduction of weapons of mass destruction in outer space. Cause and effect or a plan? I don't sure which one that was.
Oh, I think I know which one it was. So the Outer Space Treaty was open for signatures. As of March 2023, 113 countries are parties to the United Nations Outer Space Treaty. And of those 113, all are major, all are major spacefaring nations.
Important difference.
So, Tim, let's take a look at the 1967 Outer Space Treaty and how some of the questions that you mentioned earlier about proprietary rights, about murder, accidents, contamination, liability. Let's see how some of those are
addressed. Sure, good idea. There's one that the Rescue Agreement was passed in 1968, indicating that countries must take responsible steps to rescue and assist astronauts in distress and promptly return them to the launching country. As I mentioned, I was wondering, you know, accidents, who's responsible, what laws apply? Well, there is an agreement as of 1968 that you have to come to the rescue, as there are in nautical situations, I believe. If you're in a race, you have to leave that race if you see a ship in distress, that kind of thing.
Right. The 1972 Liability Convention says that a launching country shall be absolutely liable to pay compensation for damage caused by its space objects on the surface of the Earth or to aircraft when they fall out of orbit or something like that. So there is provision for that.
The Moon Agreement. Did you read about that? 1979 came into effect in 1984. It elaborates on a lot of the provisions of the Outer Space Treaty as applied to the Moon and other celestial bodies. It provides that those bodies should be exclusively for peaceful purposes and that their environments should not be disrupted and that the United Nations should be informed of the location and purpose of any station established on those bodies. The moon and its natural resources are the common heritage of mankind, and an international regime should be established to govern the exploitation of those resources when such exploitation is about to become feasible, which is essentially any day now.
It's interesting that I heard a couple of should-bes rather than shall-be, and let's just say with regard to natural resources, lithium we're finding in short supply here on the earth, but let's just say there was literally acres and acres of it, I should say hectares and hectares, on the moon. So those are resources, but it says in here that they should be for everybody. So is it sort of like you look at a waterfall here in a park? You can't dam the waterfall, but you can look at it. So does that mean you go to the moon and you could look at the lithium but not exploit it?
I think we know the answer to that is they will be exploited. And the question will become, how will they redefine words such as for the benefit of all mankind? The company says, yes, it's for the benefit. I've made it available at a very competitive price.
That's a lawyer way of getting around it. Very weaselly. Well done. The Outer Space Treaty itself from 1967 says that the exploration and use of outer space shall be for, as you mentioned, the benefit of all mankind. So there's our Weasley way around it. And secondly, outer space shall be free for exploration, not exploitation, for all. Outer space is not subject to national appropriation by claiming sovereignty, claiming it by occupation, or any other means.
Well, I think that's important to stop there, Steve. I mean, we know the history of European countries sailing to a distant shore and putting a flag in the ground and saying, this is ours. It didn't matter whether other people were living there, First Nations or what have you. There's some kind of strange construct that said, hey, I'm saying this is mine, and all the lands from here to the next coast are mine, period.
Well, Rupert's Land in Canada, a prime example, a reigning monarch in England giving a commercial company land grants and territorial use for all the waters that flow into Hudson Bay, having no idea of the extent that it was. And Rupert's Land was just basically a third of all of Canada.
So you send a spacecraft somewhere and it identifies a new celestial body. And they say, well, since we discovered it, it belongs to me.
Yeah.
That doesn't sound right.
Me being a personal space venturer, that's interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Like a gold miner laying stake.
Exactly.
Here's another one from 1967. Countries shall not place nuclear weapons or other weapons of mass destruction in orbit, or on celestial bodies, or station them in outer space in any other manner.
Sounds good.
You can have a small weapon, but not a weapon of mass destruction. Okay. What else do we have from the original 1967 Outer Space Treaty?
There is something called the Registration Convention. Now, this doesn't seem to touch on any of the concerns I had laid out earlier. The Registration Convention of 1976, countries will assist in the identification of space objects. Now, actually, there more recent, well, relatively recently to this, in the investigation of unidentified flying objects, or its new name, which is, I think I forgot.
UAPs.
UAPs.
The, yeah.
Aerial phenomenon.
Unidentified aerial phenomenon.
There is an agreement that countries should share what they found with the intention of figuring out what it was. And figuring out what it was isn't too far away from this registration convention. Countries will assist in the identification of space objects.
Yes, and I think that's got a lot to do with quietly or secretly or discreetly launching a vehicle. NORAD suddenly picks it up or any other number of ground-based radar stations, and they go, whoa, who's this?
Mm-hmm.
And so the launching country is supposed to say, oh, yes. Sorry, forgot to mention that.
Yeah, slipped our paperwork.
So we got from 1967 onwards an outer space treaty. But you know, Tim, it's really interesting. If we go back just a titch about someone flying a drone over your house and you're getting all upset about it. Well, in 1976, a number of equatorial countries were upset about geosynchronous satellites. In 1976, they formed the Bogota Declaration, and it was a challenge to the Outer Space Treaty over a sovereignty over those portions of their territory over which geostationary satellites were always up in the sky over their heads.
So what were they wanting?
I don't know if they wanted...
A piece of the action, or...
I think it's sort of similar to airlines traveling over your airspace, and mm-hmm. a fee is charged. I believe that they were seeking some kind of monetary compensation, but...
How did it play out?
Well, I'll tell you what. 8 equatorial countries versus 113. How did it play out? I think we know the answer.
And were any of those 8 equatorial countries the United States? No.
No. Nor China, nor France.
You know, it does bring up another question, though, about you've got a law, but how do you administer it? How do you enforce it? And you've got some global agreement, such as the ones we've cited, the Outer Space Treaty. And it made me think about the International Criminal Court, which has been around for a considerable length of time, has been in operation, I think arguably has done some great work. And then you have the case of the United States employing what is sometimes referred to by the United States as American exceptionalism, where they just unilaterally decide, we're not playing, we're not part of it, we're not signing it, and no American citizen can be called to account by a foreign court. How different is that from a country declaring, a space-faring country, saying it's great that you guys have agreed to this law, this rule, but we're not signing it because that shouldn't apply to us for some hypothetical piece of nonsense?
And we know that China is fringing on that. China does not openly declare its planned launches. China has recently demonstrated satellite destroying capabilities. Mind you, the United States did so earlier in the 70s, and so has the Soviet Union. So there are aspects of militarization of space, which is allowed. Indeed, the Soviets even had a space station that fired cannon shells as an experiment. But then again, who enforces that? That is a moot point. In essence, the United Nations should. Now, we know, if you want to talk about history, and of course we always must, 1952, with the invasion of South Korea by North Korea, the United Nations did have a vote. Russia decided that they would not attend as a member of the Security Council, and as a result, their veto was not recorded since they weren't in attendance. And the United Nations then said, yes, we are sending in troops, and the Korean War commenced. Canada being one of those nations. So
I didn't know that. That's an interesting example. I've got another point of comparison here, which would be the example we talked about in a previous episode of Space Talks when we were talking about the kind of fuel used by different countries in their spacecraft. Some of them are relatively environmentally friendly, if that's possible to put those thoughts together. It's a relative statement, isn't it? So yeah. The Chinese happen to be using a kind of rocket fuel that is scary bad.
The hypergolic ones, right?
That's right. And you could say, if it were a car, could they drive that car on the streets of California? And the answer would be, no, they cannot. They have to abide by the laws of California, which has for a long time been the engine of more progressive, restrictive fuels and engines that can be used on roads in California. But now we're talking about the space above us and who can make and pass laws and enforce them to say, sure, you can have a space program and you can send rockets up there, but my goodness, you shouldn't be using that kind of fuel. That's really the worst of all possible choices. Who's going to sell that to the Chinese and make it stick?
Mm-hmm.
And Steve, I got one more here, and this involves not China, but Great Britain and one of the most famous of all motor companies and car companies, the Rolls-Royce people. And they've decided that they are going to build a nuclear-powered engine that would be suitable for use in space with the encouragement and support of the British government. Now, will they do a good one? Will it be a fabulous nuclear-powered engine? Or is it one that we're going to have to all worry about?
And the talk about those nuclear-powered devices brings us back to what we talked about with regard to the Voyager 2 spacecraft and other spacecraft, which use radioisotope thermoelectric generators, typically plutonium-238. A particular isotope only has a half-life of 87 and a half years.
Which so means?
After 43.25 years, it's only half as powerful. After another 23.1 years, it's half of half again. Well, Tim, the clock on the wall says that's about all. So how about if you wrap things up for us this week?
This is Tim Woods.
And Stephen Lowry saying so long, and we'll see you next time on...
Space Talks.
Fly me to the moon. Let me play among the stars.